American playbook.
And the Red Cross is calling it a humanitarian catastrophe. 10 seconds, Toby.
Well, it is a humanitarian catastrophe, but Yemen was already in a state of humanitarian catastrophe, with hundreds of thousands being internally displaced. This is a place that has rapidly run out of water. It has very little in the way of natural resources. The Saudis are just making a bad situation worse.
Toby Jones, we want to thank you for being with us, Associate Professor of History and Director of Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers University, author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forge Modern Saudi Arabia. Previously worked with the International Crisis Group's political analyst of the Persian Gulf. That does it for our broadcast. I'll be speaking tonight in Colorado Springs, Colorado, at 7 p.m. at Celeste Hall inside the Cornerstone Arts Center. So check our website at democracynow.org. And all Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we'll be broadcasting from The Hague. It's the 100th anniversary of one of the oldest women's peace organizations in the world, the International Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berk, Renee Feltzer, Aaron Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkaff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, happening Tuesday the 21st from 5:30 to 7:45 p.m. at the Central Library in downtown Portland, and Sunday the 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the North Portland Library. The Portland Renters Assembly is a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right. There'll be a chance for individuals to tell their stories about skyrocketing rents, no-cause evictions, dubious fees, and other kinds of exploitation carried out in the name of rent. There'll be childcare, snacks, and a chance to get connected to resources for moving forward together. For more information about the Portland Renters Assembly, go to kboo.fm and click on the right side for community events.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Barack Obama has publicly apologized for a drone strike on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan that killed an American and an Italian who were being held as hostages by Al-Qaeda.
And reports have surfaced that say Comcast is pulling out of a merger deal with Time Warner Cable.
And the Portland City Council has delayed a vote on whether or not to replace the city's current open-air reservoirs and replace them with closed underground reservoirs.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 23rd, 2015. I'm Sari Gametta.
And I'm Robert Barncord. The Portland City Council yesterday approved a new policy requiring owners of large commercial buildings to track and report energy use. Nationally, buildings contribute nearly 40% of all carbon emissions. That's according to the U.S. Green Building Council. Most of these emissions come from the combustion of fossil fuels to provide heating, cooling, and lighting, and to power appliances and electrical equipment. The Green Building Council says that transforming the building sector can play a major role in reducing the threat of climate change. Here's Portland resident Charles Johnson, who will be followed by Commissioner Novick and Commissioner Amanda Fritz, who approved the measure yesterday at the City Council hearing.
We are talking only about what the city has done, but rather strangely and wonderfully, Mr. Saltzman has shown the greatest leadership here and pointed out to us that we need to expand what the city is doing to all parties. Earlier, Mr. Novick remarked about the intense climate crisis we face, and we need for this action and the principle that Mr. Saltzman put forth of expanding high standards for the city onto developers who would be just as happy to be slumlords. So as we congratulate ourselves and move forward with this, I think it's very important that we remember the earlier testimony of Kristen Pilgrim, Perry Salzhauser, Kate Hauser, Michael Von Kleek, and Brian Huell, that we're not leading anymore. We're falling behind. We're not requiring developers to go in and have sensible things like solar hot water integrated into buildings, passive solar that doesn't even need all the goofy chemicals that are in photovoltaic solar. So I hope that y'all will follow Mr. Novick's remarks and the leading action by Mr. Salzman in regard to expanding the bird protection, not just to city buildings, but to all buildings, and get the Planning and Sustainability Commission on board, getting the Bureau of Development Services on board, so that instead of passing idiotic things like Pembina and deactivation of reservoirs that would be of great service during an earthquake, we actually uphold good planning standards for everything that is built inside the city limits of Portland. Thank you.
Knowledge is power, and knowledge leads to action. I've got an example of that right here, this little step counter that tells me how many or how few steps I've taken every day, and I guarantee that I walk more since I have this thing. So when people know how much energy their buildings are using, they will spur them to use less.
Fritz.
Well, this is, again, something you've been working on for a long time, and I appreciate that, the care that with which you've worked with development and the business community to make sure that their concerns are addressed. It's clear that the voluntary incentive programs haven't seen the participation rate that we were hoping for, and so moving to a mandatory reporting is the right way to go. Thanks to Alyssa Kane and Jackie Dingfelder and others who've worked on this program, and for everybody who's participated, aye.
That was Portland City Commissioner Amanda Fritz speaking about the measure to require reporting of energy efficiency in buildings. There are approximately 5,000 commercial buildings here in Portland. Fewer than 100 of these buildings can claim Energy Star certification. The energy used to power buildings is the largest source of carbon pollution in Portland.
Also at yesterday's City Council meeting in Portland, a group of activists disrupted the meeting to bring attention to the propane terminal that is being planned for the City of Portland. The propane export terminal, which is being pushed by the Pembina Corporation, will also include a pipeline on an ecologically fragile site along the Columbia River. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with one of the protesters on KBOO this morning about why he chose to disrupt the City Council hearing.
We want to be clear to the mayor and the city council that they're not going to get a free pass and that we really want them to keep in mind the public's opposition to building this propane terminal in Portland. So a group of us decided that we wanted to remind the city council members of their own statements about the devastation of climate change and their opposition to climate change and their concern about it. So we created some sort of cartoon bubbles with quotes from the various city council members. As the council agenda was about to begin, we walked up to the front holding up faces of the council members and the quotes that they had made in the past regarding the question of climate change, and asked and made a very brief statement, 1 minute long, as to why we were doing this in response to their upcoming vote on the propane terminal, reminding them of their past opposition to fossil fuel pollution of the atmosphere, and stating our assurance that, of course, they were going to vote no on the propane terminal based on their past statements. However, as soon as we walked up to the front, the mayor, as you said, had a bit of a hissy fit and said, well, you can't do this. I won't allow this. And we sort of ignored him and continued. And He immediately slammed the gavel, said this meeting is adjourned, and he and the city council members all left the room. We continued with our one-minute statement to the people who were there at the council meeting, thanked them for their attention, reminded them that it was Earth Day, bowed to the audience and left. I suspect that the city council is going to have to realize that as they continue to ponder the question of this propane terminal, they're going to continue to get loud opposition in various forms until they agree to kill this really destructive plan.
That was Loewen Berman with Portland Rising Tide, who was one of the activists who disrupted the Portland City Council meeting yesterday morning to call for real action on climate change in honor of Earth Day.
This afternoon at 2 o'clock, the Portland City Council held a hearing on the controversial plan to replace the city's open water reservoir system with closed underground reservoirs. The city gave up its challenge to a federal rule that all reservoirs around the country be closed, this despite the fact that Portland's water comes from a pristine source in the Bull Run watershed. Today's hearing focused on the demolition of two open reservoirs and one building, and here is some of the testimony from the hearing.
Under approval criteria, we're talking protect resources. I think the big resource here is our water. I think the public needs to know that our elected officials have not been good stewards of the most valuable asset that we have in the city, which is our Bull Run water system. And I'm pretty much here today because it relates to our water being degraded. These open reservoirs need to be fully functioning as a vital component of those of that system.
So, Rosemary, we need to talk about the demolition criteria. We understand there's
because when those reservoirs are demolished, the function of those open reservoirs, which have provided healthy drinking water, will be changed and gone.
What got my attention
at the Historical Landmarks Commission is that the Water Bureau said there's no change. There's change, all right. We would be allowed, they said, to still keep that Bull Run water in the water ponds, but heavens forbid, cannot even accidentally let that good water come to our home.
As with Mount Tabor Park, the public feels their involvement to discuss the needs or alternatives for these projects has been avoided, allowing us only to engage on the what goes on top conversations. It is not empowering to discuss fences and stuff like that when there's much larger issues at play. Portland Water Bureau administrators have publicly stated, quoted, designing and building is glamorous, maintenance is boring. Well, that may be well and true, but it's the responsibility that comes with being true stewards of our public resources. In the process, Portland Water Bureau is selling out the soul of our city with overblown projects that are not needed, putting us further into deep, deep debt, spending money we desperately need elsewhere and don't have in the first place, as well as jeopardizing the health of our citizens and our children for generations to come. It is worth pointing out once again that the rush deadline to complete these projects is fabricated by the city. In a letter to the MTNA Land Use Chair Stephanie Stewart by Eric Gwinnicki, Drinking Water Enforcement Coordinator of the EPA, he reiterated that there is no federal deadline to disconnect the reservoirs. The only federal deadline was to submit a plan by April 1st, 2009, and that was compiled a long time ago, albeit without public input. The city can submit a new timeline to the OHA containing a more reasonable and community-approved mitigation plan.
Go ahead, Ms. Jones.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm representing Friends of the Reservoirs. That is the organization that placed these reservoirs at Washington Park on the National Register of Historic Places, the reason why we're here having this hearing, just as we did with the Mount Tabor reservoirs. I submitted 9 pages today speaking directly to the criteria. As has been stated by many people, the Water Bureau hasn't met the criteria for demolition. It's only in an Orwellian world of doublespeak, and the Water Bureau suggests that they have considered the value of the open reservoirs. Why is it that in presenting to the Historic Landmark Commission, or BDS, they failed to provide them with the 70-page report, the Historic Structures, Washington Park Historic Structures Report, Reservoirs 3 and 4, that was prepared in 2010? Why was that?
You're saying that's not in the record? I'm sorry.
I've submitted it to the record, And we've been stakeholders. We've been acknowledged by every commissioner, Mayor Potter, Eric Stan, Dan Salzman, for years. We've not been contacted about this process, so it has not been a good public process. It's been only about what goes on top, what happens after you demolish. But if you read the first page of this report, the reason why, to answer my own question, why is it they didn't present this to the Historic Landmark Commission? Because they want to present the reservoirs as dilapidated. But, you know, what it says is that they were carefully designed and built for durability and low maintenance. Electronic measuring or pipe controls supplement historic resources instead of replacing them. It goes on and on. But the bottom line in all of this, it says that they are generally in good condition.
Those were Portland residents testifying in opposition to the city's plan to demolish several above-ground reservoirs and replace them with underground reservoirs at a cost of about $76 million. The demolition could involve dynamiting and then further excavation. The Water Bureau admitted to the Historic Landmark Commission in March that digging at the sites could cause a landslide. A vote on the issue has been delayed until the month of May.
A bill requiring background checks for private gun purchases has cleared another hurdle in the Oregon legislature. Today, the House Committee on Rules approved the bill 5-4, with 5 Democrats voting yes and 4 Republicans voting no. The vote came after an 8-hour hearing last night where supporters and opponents publicly testified on the bill. The bill would expand criminal background checks to include most gun purchases between private citizens. Criminal background checks are currently required only when people buy guns at a show or a dealer. The bill could reach the House floor for a final vote as early as next week. If it passes, it will move to Governor Kate Brown for her signature.
About 460,000 Oregonians juggle their own jobs and family lives to care for relatives who are older or have a disability. A coalition made its case today to the Oregon legislature that these folks need support from the state in the form of services and training so they can help their relatives remain at home. KABU's Elizabeth Gleason has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
A new AARP survey of Oregonians ages 45 and older finds most of them are or one day will be caregivers for an aging family member. Groups that want the state to acknowledge that and to pitch in to help converge on the Capitol today. As lawmakers wrestle with budget decisions, the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities is asking them not to trim the programs and services that allow many people to stay at home as they age. John Bartholomew with AARP Oregon says a strong safety net ends up saving the state money.
The state of Oregon, through Medicaid, pays for a lot of long-term care. The longer somebody is being taken care of in their own home by a loved one who has appropriate training, appropriate resources, the less cost on the taxpayers.
He points out that about 460,000 Oregonians are providing unpaid care for family members, which is worth an estimated $5.5 billion a year. The coalition warns that if the Oregon kicker tax rebate is triggered, which is likely, it'll leave less money for safety net services at a time when the state's aging population is booming. In the AARP Oregon survey, 76% of respondents says they support resources and training for family caregivers. The legislature created Oregon Care Partners to provide some of that training, from medication management to dementia care. But after only 1 year, its funding expires at the end of June. Project Director Angela Neal says the in-person and online classes have been well received.
The need is overwhelming. And so we are a resource to help train these individuals so they know how to better care for their loved ones, to give them support. And it also helps them to have a less stressful caregiving experience.
The legislature also is considering a bill known as the CARE Act to keep family caregivers informed when a relative is released from the hospital and to ensure they get some basic training if needed for post-discharge care. It passed unanimously this week in the House Committee on Health Care and heads to the House floor for a vote. For KBOO Evening News, this is Elizabeth Gleason in collaboration with Oregon News Service.
Portland school board elections are coming up on May 19th. Last night, the League of Women's Voters held their voters forum at the school board building. KBOO's Joe Meyer was on the scene and filed this report.
Over 200 citizens packed the hearing room at the Portland School Board building on Dixon Street last night to hear from school board candidates. District 1 has two candidates, PSU student and Steve Buell endorsed Andrew Davidson, running against the teacher union's endorsed PSU professor Julius Barza Brown. In District 2, longtime school activist Paul Anthony faces Emerge Oregon graduate Emma Russick Williams, Milagro Theater's Jose Gonzalez, and high school advocate John Sweeney. Zone 3 features the only incumbent running, Bobby Regan, facing district employee and volunteer Gretchen Hollins, school activist Ann Konstam, and candidate Wes Soderbeck. Mike Rosen is the only candidate from Zone 7 and was not at the event last night. Here are some voter responses from the forum.
They nicely avoided any questions about the competence of the current management and administration.
I have to say I was super impressed that one of the most well-spoken candidates was a recent graduate of Portland Public Schools. I thought that was amazing.
There seem to be some credible candidates in each zone. There are definitely some candidates who don't seem terribly credible. But it's encouraging that there seem to be credible candidates across the board. I definitely like Paul Anthony. I definitely like Andrew Davidson. And there are two candidates in Zone 3 that I'm interested in. Neither of them were Bobby Regan.
Hi, I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News. I wonder if anything stuck out in your mind tonight you may want to share.
Well, all of the candidates had really interesting and important values around education, public education, and everybody sort of had good things to say, except for maybe one or two candidates. I was impressed with everybody, so I'll have to study their literature and everything else a little more carefully.
Well, I was very impressed with the candidate, the young man who was on the school board as a student candidate. I thought he did a really good job. I think he would be a great asset to the board.
A lot of calls for change. I think that's the reflection of how Portlanders are feeling about our district.
Any candidates stick out in your mind?
Yeah, I'll go on record. I think the young gentleman who was a student candidate last year brought in a really refreshing perspective. I think his name is Andrew Davidson. Nice to hear him speak about the focus being on the students, and sometimes I think that gets lost. I think we get focused on the politics, and Andrew's definitely going to, if elected, bring us back into the classroom. So Andrew stood out. Paul Anthony stood out.
Paul Anthony's in Zone 2. What do you like about him?
Very articulate, very intelligent, answered the question substantively, got a real sense of the program that he would be promoting.
Yeah. Of all the candidates, I think, Paul, you have a sense of what he would specifically be working toward and what he would not be working toward. And that transparency was unique among all the candidates.
Steve Buell was in the house and added this.
Andrew Davidson and Paul Anthony really were a little bit above everybody else, and that's because they were really addressing what I felt are the most important problems in the school system, and they did a better job of it than the rest of the people, all of whom did pretty darn well. I had a couple people who had ideas that I disagreed with, but generally, yeah, I felt those two people really stood out. I thought they did a better job of addressing what the problems really are in a broad way. There are other people maybe address problems in categories, but not in such a broad way that they did. There's a lot of problems. This is a complex system. You know, it's huge. And you just can't kind of come in with one viewpoint. We're going to do this one thing or this one thing. And they understand that. And I thought that came across in the evening.
Portland school board elections are May 19th. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
This Saturday at noon, employees of the Portland area television station KGW will hold a rally in Pioneer Square to draw attention to changes made by the Gannett News Service, which bought the station back in 2013. Since then, employees and viewers have complained of a drop in production quality, which unionized workers at the station blame on Gannett's layoffs and longtime employees' hiring of amateur producers and their use of distant automated technology for tasks that were once done by individuals at KGW's facilities. For more on this, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Dave Tweedle with IATSE Local 600, which represents workers at KGW and other stations here in Portland and in Seattle.
TV stations operate under license from the federal government. They are not just profit-making assets that you can do what you want to. The license comes free of charge from the taxpayers, and we believe that everybody in Portland has a significant interest in what happens to that TV station. So we're going to present to the public what's going on at the collective bargaining table and what Gannett is doing with their business model. And we believe their business model is contrary to the best interests of all the other stakeholders. So we'll be discussing that. Interestingly enough, just this week, they changed their corporate name. They'll no longer be called Gannett. They'll be called Tegna, which is taking two letters out. Somebody's already made the joke that two of the letters got laid off, and what's left is getting paid less.
Speaking of layoffs, can you tell me how many jobs were lost at KGW due to the business structure changes?
So far, there have been four jobs lost. Those are people that worked in the engineering department of the station as they automated the facilities that queue up the stories and sound and sync up the stories and sound. And so that's now being done off-site. Actually, I believe it's being done in the state of Florida.
Can you give some examples of the quality loss in reporting at KGW?
Sure. My favorite one was I saw this. It took place a couple months ago. But they were doing a light story about the carpet at PDX Airport. And the anchors then pitched the story to the reporter who was supposed to go live at the airport. And what you got was about 8 or 9 seconds of a picture of the carpet. And then the reporter literally runs into the frame of the camera and tries to explain what's going on, but they've used up their time slot and nobody ever got any information out of the story. I've seen other examples where there was a demonstration by the local cab drivers at Pioneer Square about the Uber that was coming in, and they showed a bunch of cabs that parked in the square, and then they showed the guy who was speaking on behalf of the local cab drivers, and there was no sound. Those are the kinds of coding errors and just management of the files that have been disrupted by the outsourcing of the work of that particular task.
Can you tell me a little bit about what's happening this Saturday?
Saturday at noon, 12 noon till 2 o'clock, we have a musical act. We invite all the public to come enjoy the music and talk about the future of local television. The Norman Sylvester Band has got a five-piece band to be playing. We'll have Tom Chamberlain from the state AFL-CIO speaking, and we'll also have some local office holders are going to come and express their support. And the main thing I want to say is that this is a celebration of what KGW has meant to this community. We're not angry at local management at all. Local management has always, you know, done what they can to put quality programming and vital news in front of the public, and it's Gannett's business model gets in their way and makes it much more difficult for them to do their jobs.
All right, Dave Tweedle, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Dave Tweedle, a business representative with IATSE Local 600, who represents photographers and editors at KGW and K2 in Portland.
Hours after the Federal Communications Commission announced their plan to schedule a hearing on the proposed Comcast-Time Warner merger, reports have surfaced that Comcast may pull out of the deal altogether. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with the media reform organization Free Press about the flurry of activity connected with the apparently now abandoned plan to merge the country's two largest cable providers.
I'm talking with Timothy Carr. He is the Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press, and we're going to talk about the variety of developments with regard to the Comcast-Time Warner cable merger.
You want an update on Comcast-Time Warner cable? Because there's certainly a lot to report. In the last 48 hours, there have been a number of developments. And this is a deal that was introduced more than a year ago. Federal regulators have come to realize what I think most Americans also realize, that merging the two largest cable companies is not a good idea. There have been reports that the Department of Justice is moving towards rejecting the merger. The Department of Justice looks at the merger on antitrust grounds, and that the Federal Communications Commission is also looking to thoroughly vet the merger in a way that would make it nearly impossible for approval. And so within the last couple of hours, we've heard that Comcast is now planning to withdraw its merger proposal. So that marks a significant victory for internet users, cable customers, anyone who wants to see more competition in a marketplace where there are too few providers, and as a result, the prices are very high.
Is there a difference between the two agencies that make the FCC's decision a more severe blow?
Yes, well, they have different criteria. The Department of Justice looks at the antitrust ramifications of mergers of this scale. And the questions that they would be asking are about the level of competition in the marketplace, the number of choices that consumers have, whether a merged entity dominates too much of the marketplace. So that's the scrutiny that they were providing, whereas the Federal Communications Commission has a slightly broader mandate. And they look to see whether a merger is indeed in the public interest. Now, the public interest is somewhat loosely defined. It often depends on who's in charge at any given time at the FCC. But in this case, under FCC Chairman Wheeler, he is very keen on making sure that more Americans gain access to affordable internet services. So I think that sort of criteria that he was looking for, will Comcast help spread access to high-speed services as this merged entity, or is it better to have more players in the marketplace that's already fairly limited?
I'm recalling some hearings about a month ago where members of Congress seemed to insist that internet services here in the United States is better than anywhere.
Yeah. This is kind of the way Washington works, unfortunately, that there are a number of think tanks out there that generate reports. They look at the market and they look at the data and they create analysis. And what a corrupted that process is that the phone and cable lobby is spending a lot of money on think tanks. So at the time, you had a few think tanks that were funded by companies like Comcast who were paying analysts to produce research that said the United States had faster, cheaper, better internet connections than in places like Europe and Asia. And that research that was cited during those congressional hearings was soon debunked by organizations like Akamai, which do not play this game inside Washington, but actually look at real data related to access and costs around the world, which found that, in fact, on almost every measure of broadband access, that Americans were paying far more for speeds that were inferior to what's available in much of Europe and some more developed parts of Asia.
I've been talking with Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press. For more information, you can visit their website at freepress.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly cloudy with steady rain predicted for the afternoon, a high of about 57, the low way down at 44. Today in history, back in 1968, students at Columbia University in New York City took over administration buildings and shut down the university to protest the escalating Vietnam War. And in 1993, on this day, a referendum in Eritrea resulted in overwhelming support for independence from Ethiopia, precipitating a war between the countries 5 years later. The quote for today is from the quantum physicist Max Planck, born on this day in 1858. In the last analysis, we ourselves are part of nature and therefore part of the mystery that we are trying to solve.
It's 5:33, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
As everyone who travels a lot soon learns, when you stay in the hotels of the big chains, it's easy to forget where you are, since they're all alike, offering all the charm of No Place USA. This disorienting sameness has become more dizzying in recent years as the chains have merged and conglomerated. Weary travelers might choose to stay overnight in one of the Residence Inn hotels, or a Courtyard, the Town Place Suites, or even splurge for a night in a ritzy Ritz-Carlton. In fact, though, you're in a Marriott, the $14 billion a year combine that owns all of the above chains, along with 15 others. Marriott is among the world's 10 largest hotel operators that have a combined 113 different chains in their crowded stable of brand names. Naturally, as uniformity and conglomeration have taken over the industry, a consumer rebellion has erupted, with more and more travelers, especially younger ones, seeking out independent hotels, unique inns, and local B&Bs. They prefer the uncorporate places that have cool names like The Moxie, Canopy, and Vibe. But, oh crud, guess what? All three of those are chains of hip hotels that opened in the past year and are owned respectively by Marriott, Hilton, and Best Western. Known in the industry as lifestyle hotels, these fake independent lodgings are the hot new niche for mega conglomerates trying to nab travelers in search of authenticity. The big hotel chains are in the business of pretending they aren't big chains, says Pauline Frommer, editor of the well-regarded Frommer's Travel Guides. They want you to think they are boutiques. This is Jim Hightower saying, sneaky. But do they think that duping customers is a good business strategy? Not only will we dupees quickly see that we're being sold plastic authenticity, but we'll also be PO'd about it. Good luck with that.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
President Obama publicly apologized for a drone strike in January, which accidentally killed one American and one Italian. Warren Weinstein and Giovanni Laporto were aid workers being held hostage in the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Both were killed in a drone strike targeting leaders of Al-Qaeda. President Obama personally apologized to the families of both men. He said that, as a parent and husband, he could not imagine the pain and grief they were going through. The president also defended the operation and praised his administration's willingness to look into this mistake. He said that his act of transparency was proof of American exceptionalism.
Our initial assessment indicates that this operation was fully consistent with the guidelines under which we conduct counterterrorism efforts in the region, which has been our focus for years because it is the home of Al-Qaeda's leadership. And based on the intelligence that we had obtained at the time, including hundreds of hours of surveillance, we believed that this was an Al-Qaeda compound, that no civilians were present, and that capturing these terrorists was not possible. And we do believe that the operation did take out dangerous members of Al-Qaeda. What we did not know, tragically, is that Al-Qaeda was hiding the presence of Warren and Giovanni in this same compound. It is a cruel and bitter truth that in the fog of war generally, and our fight against terrorists specifically, mistakes, sometimes deadly mistakes, can occur. But one of the things that sets America apart from many other nations, one of the things that makes us exceptional, is our willingness to confront squarely our imperfections and to learn from our mistakes. We will do our utmost to ensure it is not repeated. And we will continue to do everything we can to prevent the loss of innocent lives, not just innocent Americans, but all innocent lives in our counterterrorism operations.
The Guardian points out that this is only the second time that President Obama has acknowledged the deaths of innocent people in U.S. counterterrorism operations. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism reports that 2,464 people have been killed by drone strikes between the years 2004 and 2015.
Loretta Lynch's nomination for Attorney General has finally been approved, making her the first female African-American Attorney General in U.S. history. The Senate voted 56 to 43 in favor, with 46 Democrats and 10 Republicans voting yes. The confirmation comes after a long and contentious process. Senate Republicans stonewalled Lynch's confirmation after she agreed with President Obama's executive order to block deportations of 4 million undocumented immigrants. Senator Mitch McConnell has also delayed the vote until the Senate passed an earlier bill on human trafficking. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, Lynch's confirmation process took longer than the last seven nominees combined.
The family of Michael Brown has officially filed a civil lawsuit against the city of Ferguson, Missouri. The plans were announced last month after the Justice Department and a grand jury decided not to charge Darren Wilson in the death of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown. Wilson, a white police officer, shot and killed Brown in August of 2014. Wilson and Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson have both resigned, but they have not suffered any legal consequences. Brown's family attorney says that the lawsuit will present a clearer vision of the evidence used in the original investigation.
In our case, we plan to show and outline pretty much the same evidence. However, you will get a more clearer, a more accurate picture of what took place that day. We feel, and we've always felt from the very beginning, that Officer Darren Wilson did not have to shoot and kill Mike Brown Jr. in broad daylight in the manner that he did, that he had other options available to him, and that he chose deadly force as his option. And we plan to demonstrate in a court of law to reasonable-minded people that the choice to use deadly force was unreasonable and unnecessary under those circumstances.
The Brown family is seeking $75,000 in damages.
The Senate Committee on Finance advanced legislation that would grant President Obama authority to fast-track a massive trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. However, critics of the trade deal are sounding the alarm. They say the TPP will cost American jobs and even circumvent U.S. law. Anthony J. Rivera has a story from the U.S. Capitol.
As Thursday night's Senate Finance Committee markup hearing on the latest trade legislation wore on into the evening, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown quipped to his tired colleagues about the unusual political alliances that have emerged.
One of the great things about this night is I've just found that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle have this new incredible trust in the President of the United States and admiration, and they seem almost to idolize him tonight, that we should give him all the power and trust him to do these negotiations.
Republicans are big fans of the Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA, which would allow the president so-called fast-track authority on the latest trade deal. Fast-track is sort of a legislative abnormality that forces an up or down vote straight to the Senate floor, and no one can offer amendments along the way. Senator Brown's fellow Democrat on the committee, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, also finds himself aligned with Republicans. He and Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch of Utah worked closely to reach a deal on the bill. Hatch admits there are Senate Republicans that still need to be convinced. And Wyden's now feeling heat from Oregonians who are unhappy with his stance on TPA.
Supporting a trade agenda.
I've always said the same thing on that issue. The best politics is doing the right thing. That's what I'm focused on.
But is this policy the right thing to do? As a presidential candidate, Obama said past trade agreements were made with interests that are contrary to American workers. And in this year's State of the Union speech, the president admitted broken promises have resulted from similar deals.
And our trade agreements should not just be good for Wall Street, it should also be good for Main Street. And the problem that we've had is that we've had corporate lobbyists oftentimes involved in negotiating these trade agreements, but the AFL-CIO hasn't been involved. Ordinary working people have not been involved. And we've got to make sure that our agreements are good for everybody.
Patrick Woodall is a research director at Food and Water Watch, an advocacy group seeking greater protection for consumers. He says the American people are getting a raw deal with TPA and, by extension, TPP.
These are secret trade deals that pose considerable risk to the kind of safeguards to America's public health and consumer protection and the environment that really need to be dealt with in a more straightforward ways.
The negotiations for the Pacific Partnership deal have been shrouded in secrecy. This year, WikiLeaks released a chapter of the TPP agreement dealing with trade tribunals, whose mission is to adjudicate disputes between corporations and governments. Woodall points out that these tribunals would likely circumvent U.S. law. Senator Wyden insists he and Hatch fortified TPA with transparency and accountability provisions. Wyden says the TPP agreement will be available to the public somewhere for 2 months before President Obama signs the agreement. There's also language meant to ensure human rights and intellectual property rights are addressed. But the Senate measure does not address currency manipulation in partnering countries, where American goods are then harder to sell. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont couldn't disagree more with his fellow Democrats and Obama on TPA and TPP.
The president is wrong. President Obama, who I have a lot of respect for, is dead wrong on this issue.
Sanders jammed up the momentum of the Hatch-Wyden bill with an objection just minutes before the hearing began, causing the morning markup to reach well into the evening. As the Senate Finance Committee's markup continued on past dinner time, Chairman Hatch encouraged committee members to vote down as many amendments as possible. The fewer the amendments, he argued, the better the chance for both chambers to pass the bill. House Ways and Means Chairman Paul Ryan conducted his own TPA markup hearing today. It remains to be seen how much support with House Republicans there really is for the trade deal before leadership will have to find help from Democrats. Anthony J. Rivera, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
On April 24th, in 1915, as many as 270 prominent members of the minority Armenian community were rounded up in Constantinople, the capital at that time of the Ottoman Empire. That date is generally considered to mark the beginning of the Armenian Genocide, in which most of those first few hundred detainees were killed, along with between 1 and 1.8 million other Armenians between the years 1915 and 17. Tomorrow will be the 100th anniversary of the genocide, and many countries around the world will hold official commemorations of the killings, along with the whole of the global Armenian diaspora, which has largely created as people fled the Ottoman government. Despite the widespread use of the word genocide to describe what happened in the ancestral